Hi, I'm Mike Dilk and you're listening to the Relax Back UK show, the show that explores all kinds of health topics relevant to you, your family and your friends. Each week I talk to expert guests from a range of backgrounds to inform and entertain you. So please do join the Relax Back UK family and stay tuned.
Hi, and thank you for joining me on the Relax Back UK show. Now, how are you feeling? It may seem many of us are feeling a little tired, possibly even completely exhausted, pretty much all the time.
I believe a third of us said it was because of work, we're feeling exhausted. Half of us because of our sleep. Others blamed it on the kids, news, current affairs, social media. 1 in 10 of us didn't know the root cause.
I chat with dietitian Lucy Diamond about this, and we talk about some possible things that can help you if this describes you. Then, what's been spoken about here?
But just broadly speaking, you know, 2000 holes, micro holes, which are sort of, you know, a couple of millimeters in width and 5 millimeters in depth, it becomes a breeding ground for potential infection. So everything carries its own risk. When you've got open wounds, wherever it might be, if it's not done in a sterile form, then you're going to be putting yourself at risk of infection. Of course you are.
It is hair transplants. And if you're considering one, Dr. Manish Mittal has some advice for you. Please do stay tuned for a great show.
This show is cool!
Before the first guest, I just want to mention a book I've recently published called Cut the Crap, Ask the Questions That Matter About Your Health. It contains many of the answers to questions that I've asked the experts on the show over the years, and will also encourage the reader to ask questions about their own health. It's available on Amazon and is great as a gift for anyone who's interested in health. It's called Cut the Crap, Ask the Questions That Matter About Your Health. The first topic is being tired all the time with dietitian Lucy Diamond. But my first question to her was, what's the difference between a dietitian and a nutritionist?
Really, really good question, Mike. So I'd say, in a nutshell, dietitian, both have degrees behind. So there's probably a difference in the terminology of registered, I have to say. So for a dietitian, it is a 3 to 4 year university degree. It's a science degree. And as part of that, you have placements within a medical setting. So very much involved in community work, in hospital work. For a nutritionist, it is a 3 year university degree. When you come out the other side, to become a registered nutritionist, it's joining something like the Association for Nutrition. You can do shorter courses to become a nutritionist, but there is that difference between registered nutritionist. And I'd say the key difference between dietitian and nutritionist is a dietitian is a healthcare professional.
Okay. All right. I might add another one, actually, if I may.
Yeah, go for it.
Being a dietitian is a reserved title. So this afternoon, if I called myself a dietitian, I could get in deep trouble. But I could call myself a nutritionist now and charge people for advice. And well, it'd be bonkers to take it, but I wouldn't get any trouble at all, would I?
That's true. So yeah, dietitian is a protected title. And I said you have to be have to have done your university degree. And most of us go on to register with the Healthcare Professionals Council.
Right. OK, so if you're thinking of talking to a dietitian or a nutrition, ask for their qualifications, because my experience is if people are qualified, they're perfectly happy to tell you what their qualifications are in any walk of life, actually.
Yeah. Amazing advice. Absolutely.
Good. All right. So the subject in hand, the subject we want to chat about for a few minutes is how we're all feeling just exhausted. Well, first of all, lots of people do feel exhausted, but is it any worse than it has been ever? I mean, we're always exhausted and always have been, aren't we?
Yeah, I feel that. Hopefully I can come to inspire you, but I am painting a bit of a bleak picture to begin with. So I'm on today with some research from Lyft, which is a company that specializes in products to help people manage their blood glucose levels, whether that's diabetes, sports, everyday energy. And it's really to talk about some of their evidence that shows exactly that. They conducted a survey and it came back that 71% of us admit to feeling more fatigued now than we did 5 years ago, pre-COVID.
Okay. This is the opposite, though, of Turkey's voting for Christmas, isn't it? They want us all to feel exhausted because that's their business.
Hopefully, but I'm here with that scientific hat on to think about how can we prevent ourselves from feeling fatigued and exhausted? What can we do about it from a day-to-day diet and lifestyle perspective? And then maybe what tricks we have in our back pocket if we do feel exhausted and need that quick energy boost.
Okay. Well, I am one of those people that always feels exhausted. You know, I've got a full-time job, I've got family, I've got kids I've got to look after, I'm always running around.
Yeah.
And I do feel tired. So, Lucy,
yes.
Give me some advice. What am I going to do about it?
Yes, what are you going to do about it? I suppose you highlighted some of the key themes that actually came out in the trial there and the research, Mike. So most of us reported feeling exhausted because of work. I believe a third of us said it was because of work, we're feeling exhausted. Half of us because of our sleep. Others blamed it on the kids, news, current affairs, social media. 1 in 10 of us didn't know the root cause. So I think if we know the root cause, lack of sleep, we can come up with that solution. Let's look at how many hours sleep I'm getting. Am I getting the recommended guidance? Over 6 hours, ideally 8 hours sleep per night. If I'm not, how do I work backwards? What's causing that? Am I reaching for a coffee, a tea, that caffeine mid-afternoon to pick me up? If so, should I look at that? Can I go decaf? Can I think about eliminating caffeine in the afternoon? I think when it comes to some of the other problems, I'm not sure we can eliminate work, the kids, the news, the current affairs.
I just want to ask you about the caffeine thing.
Yes.
So I love coffee and I drink both decaffeinated and coffee with caffeine. But, yep. You know, if you have a cup of coffee with caffeine, you know, maybe one or two a day when you're feeling a bit tired, you know,
yep.
Is that really going to stop you from sleeping at nighttime? You know, does it really have any lasting effects that are bad? I mean, I get it. If you're on 15 or 20 cups of coffee a day, that's different. But you know, one or two, does it really do any harm?
No, from a health perspective, no. But for some of us that struggle to get to sleep in the evening, I'd have a look at the half-life of caffeine is about 5 to 6 hours. So you want to work backwards. What time is my bedtime?
You make it sound like it's some nuclear thing. What do you mean by half-life?
It is a stimulant. So how long it lasts in our body, in essence. So we drink a coffee, but actually the caffeine can last in our system much longer than the hour or two later. It can stay in our system for 5 to 6 hours. So you want to work.
So that's not half-life. That's 100% life. It's gone after five. Okay.
Sometimes it can last
start
eight.
Doing half and half and half. It never goes, does it? It stays
around
for
up
thousands
all night.
Of years. Yeah, all right.
No.
So 5 or 6 hours, it'll be out your system.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, okay.
So work backwards. When's my bedtime? How many hours can I have my last coffee, my last tea? And not all of us respond in the same way. Some of us can drink, like you said, much more higher tolerance to caffeine. It doesn't affect us. But if we are struggling to get to sleep, we are having poor sleep. Let's look at some of the causes.
Yeah. Okay. That makes very, very good sense. What about some other things? What about eating regular meals or not, as the case may be? Will that make any difference?
Yeah, absolutely. When we looked at the study, kind of the most popular time for having that energy dip, that slump in energy, that afternoon slump, is post-lunch. So we can definitely look at what do we avoid that post-afternoon slump, and it is what we're eating. With regards to our lunchtime meals, particularly heading into the winter, we probably crave much more home comfort meal, a heavy meal at lunch. Actually, if we're having a meal really high in carbohydrates, quite a large meal, what we're going to find is that we get this rise in our blood glucose levels, but mid-afternoon, those glucose levels start to fall. So we want to think about what we're having at that lunchtime meal. Is it high in fiber? Is it high in protein? Is it carbohydrate that's whole grains? So things that are digested really nice and slowly, so they break down slowly, giving you a trickle of energy over the afternoon, not this refined carbohydrate meal, high drop, high rise, quick drop, and we're left feeling low in energy. You want to think about foods that are digested nice and slowly over that afternoon.
So your body digests these things fast and converts the carbohydrate and all the rest of it to sugars, to glucose, which goes into your blood.
Yes.
And that's what you need. But if that happens quickly, you're
going to
feel fine for 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And then you crash.
Exactly that. And that leaves us reaching for that caffeine, reaching for those fizzy drinks, reaching for those sugary fixes mid-afternoon to try and get some energy.
Which will do the same thing, actually. If you have a sugary drink, you'll get a blast of sugar and save you for 20 minutes and then you'll collapse again.
Absolutely. Absolutely that.
Okay. So yeah, eat sensibly, as much as is possible. Okay.
Yeah.
And also,
Sorry, go for it, Mike. Talking over
well,
you.
I was going to say, if I have a big meal in the middle of the day, I feel like I want to go to sleep. And then if I have a big meal at the end of the day, I can't go to sleep.
I know, you can't wait. So it's all about that portion size, all about looking at what we're eating, speed of digestion, high in fiber, high in protein, not too much carbohydrates, slow digestion to really trickle feed that blood sugar over the days.
Okay.
I suppose one thing to talk about, if you are feeling you're doing the right things, you're trying to avoid it, you're still getting that slump mid-afternoon, what other things can you do? Obviously, the research is carried out by Lift. So they have products that boost those energy levels, such as their active energy boosts that are lower in calories, but they do contain glucose to lift that. But they have vitamins and minerals. And I think that's where we're often lacking and can feel fatigued and tired. So are we low in vitamin D? Are we low in our B vits? Are we low in vitamin C? So you can get a boost from vitamin and minerals, making sure you're eating a well-balanced diet to make sure you're not lacking in any nutrients.
Yeah, that boost, that's not going to come in the next few minutes though, is it? The glucose will kick in a few minutes, but your vitamins, if you're having a healthy balanced diet, that's over a matter of weeks or months, isn't it?
A longer term vision. Yeah, absolutely. I
So
suppose.
actually, if you take these things, you'll feel fine for 20 minutes and then crash again, like the other stuff.
Yeah, and so mid-afternoon snacks, you want to again think high protein, high fiber. I don't want to sound too much of a dietitian with telling you to eat your veg, but something a really nice afternoon snack, slices of apple, but with some peanut butter on. So you get a bit of extra protein in there. You've got your fiber from your apple, nice and slowly digested. Instead of the what we really want, that packet of chocolate biscuits and a cup of tea,
Mars
it won't.
bar.
We're all human, but actually,
Yeah.
to help us in the long run, to help those energy levels make us feel better, go for something higher protein, higher fiber.
Okay. All right. Let's think of some other ways. I must admit, I had a little root around on the NHS website
Yes.
of ways to try and make us feel less tired.
Yeah.
And one thing came up, which I thought was interesting, exercise. The
Yes.
last thing you feel like doing when you're just feeling knackered anyway is doing some exercise.
Yeah. And it's true. It's the last thing we feel like doing, but actually one of the best things. So light physical activity boosts your energy, improves your circulation, gets more oxygen around your body, and actually can improve your energy levels. And also exercise outside. This is particularly important in the winter months. Some of us can suffer from SAD, so seasonal affective disorder, that can make us feel depressed because of actually lack of natural light. So a walk in the middle of the day, I'd like to say out in the sunshine, but let's be honest, this is England, not
Actually, I'm
maybe
looking
in summer.
outside. It's quite sunny just now outside my window.
Ah,
It's not terribly warm, but it's not
yeah,
raining. Makes a
it's
change in the
not
last few
raining.
days.
But out in some natural light, need that natural light, need some vitamin D, and get that body moving can really help your energy levels throughout the day.
Yeah, very good. Another thing they suggest is, which is one of those, all these things are easy to say and not necessarily easy to do,
Yeah.
reduce stress.
Yes. Yes,
Now
it's
that
one of
might come
those
from
ones.
work or it might come from home life or whatever, but reduce stress.
It's one of those ones like saying cheer up when someone's sad, isn't it? Kind of your
Yeah,
stress, reduce your
you want to
stress.
smack them.
Yeah, exactly. I suppose there are some techniques that we can think about in our day for reducing stress. Again, stepping away from digital, stepping away from our laptops, stepping into the fresh air, some deep breathing. It's a bit of Marmite, but some people, for them, meditation, mindfulness during the day can really help you not only reduce your stress levels, but help you stay focused and energized, actually.
Okay, another one I suggested, which I can really imagine, less alcohol.
Yes.
Why does that work though? So if I have a few beers in the night, I feel like I sleep better. So why am I tired the next day?
Yeah, for some people, it actually disturbs their sleep. So you can find us waking, particularly if you've been heavy drinking. You might find you wake in the early hours of the morning, 2 to 4. Actually, your body's dipped in their blood glucose levels. It's waking you up to say, hey, you've been drinking alcohol. What happens when you drink alcohol, sorry to go too scientific here, is your liver stops producing glucose that it normally does overnight. Well, it depends if you've been drinking overnight, but normally your liver can get rid of 1 unit of alcohol per hour. But
Right.
in because it prioritizes get rid of that alcohol, it stops prioritizing that little trickle of glucose you get. So you might find your blood glucose levels dip during the night and you wake up. So people often find disturbed sleep off the back of alcohol rather than sleeping better.
Okay. All right. No,
And
that makes sense.
dehydration. I think it's the dehydration as well. So alcohol can actually leave you feeling rather dehydrated the next day. And again, dehydration can lead to fatigue, can lead to low energy levels. So one of my
All right.
top tips of low energy levels as well, whether it's alcohol or non-alcohol related, hydration is key.
Okay. Goodness, right, we've whizzed through quite a few things there, haven't we?
Yes.
Eating, exercise, sleep,
Yeah.
stress,
Yes.
caffeine, alcohol, drink enough water.
Yeah.
Actually, there was one other thing on the NHS website which I thought was good. Lose some weight.
Yeah, what, being a healthy weight, trying to achieve a healthy weight. Lots of health benefits if you're living with obesity or living with overweight, health benefits associated with even 5% weight loss. So reducing your risk of diabetes, reducing your risk of certain cancers, but on a day-to-day, increasing energy levels.
Yeah. Okay. We've been through a few things there. You mentioned these lift active stuff. Anything else that you want to bring in?
It's just a big thank you for to Lift really of some of the research they conducted looking at why our energy levels are low, what we're reaching for as a result of that. So we're reaching for coffee, 40% of us reaching for coffee, 30% of us reaching for chocolate, 18% of us reaching for fizzy drinks, and about 40% of us admitting we're reliant on these quick energy fixes. So it's been a pleasure working alongside them and thinking about actually what can we do to combat the nation's low energy levels.
Yeah, but these things do actually contain what sugar contains, don't they? So I mean, this is like a short-term fix occasionally. It's not something you should have every day.
Yeah, absolutely. So Lift has worked really closely, and their products are used extensively within diabetes management. So managing blood glucose levels, used in sports to help manage again blood glucose levels, energy levels as well. But with their product containing vitamins and minerals, it could be an option, a lower calorie option of an energy boost. Not something I'll be saying have every day as part of your diet as essential, but there is a back pocket go-to with some vitamins and minerals in should you need that boost. But the focus here is definitely about avoiding those slumps in energy, those top tips of things that we can do day to day, looking at avoiding heavy meals, having nice, well-balanced meals, thinking about staying hydrated, getting moving, getting out into the sunlight, managing your caffeine intake, prioritizing your sleep,
Yeah.
and
And
lots of top tips for thinking about how to manage that work-life balance.
eat your veg.
Eat your veg. There is
Yeah.
lots of scientific papers on eating your veg, 8 to 10.
I have to say, I do get worried sometimes. I live in London, well, just north of London. I go into London quite a lot and I'm on the tube. And these adverts on the tube, there's five adverts opposite a bank of seats. And I sit there and count the number of adverts which are for supplements and vitamins and this sort of thing. And it's not that uncommon for two out of five to be for supplements and vitamins and all this kind of thing. And I sit there and I think, well, do you really just end up with expensive pee? And if you eat a well-balanced diet, you don't need it anyway. It looks like just marketing. So that we buy some of this stuff, and it worries me. Is it really necessary?
Yeah, as a dietitian, I'm with you, Mike. I'm food first. So can we get what we need from our food? Majority of the time, yes. I think with our work lives and our patterns, being indoors, the weather, vitamin D, questionable whether we get enough. So that's probably one supplement that I always say, actually, we probably should explore. And in COVID, the government changed the rules to say everyone should be having vitamin D throughout the year. But with regards to the other vitamins and minerals, if our diet is well balanced, then yes, we should be able to get everything through there. If we are not eating well for various reasons, then we could consider a multivitamin supplement. But you're right, kind of what you don't use from it, you would pee out. But it is weighing up, what does your diet look like? For me, maximizing food first.
Sure. Okay. What one other issue that I do think about, and this might be a bit unfair question for a dietitian, because it's not so much about our guts and our body, it's about our teeth. If we have snacks which are sugary, you know, whether it's glucose or fructose or sugar that is on the bowl on the table, this is not great for our teeth.
No, it's a really good point. And thinking about the timing, so actually speaking with a dentist recently, looking about the timing of glucose, making sure it's at a meal time, so you're not constantly exposing your teeth to that potential decay as well. But it is something actually we probably should talk about more as dietitians, because we talk about gut health, we talk about energy levels, we talk about long-term health, but actually your teeth are part of that bigger picture.
Very much so. All right. So look, this is an important topic because it does affect everyone. Everyone feels a bit tired at some point.
Yeah.
If people are worried because they're thinking, blimey, I feel a bit tired every day, or, you know, a bit more than I feel I should be. And actually, they do want to try and do something serious about it. What is a good source of information for them?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm here on behalf of Lift today. We have some incredible blogs. They are backed by scientific evidence. They have professional writers writing evidence on their website. So liftglucose.com. Another source of information would be somewhere like the British Dietetic Association website from a dietary perspective. Obviously, if you are feeling extremely fatigued and you need to talk to someone about it, it's not normal for you, then I would say consult a healthcare professional. Speak to your GP. Check your
actually. Account. That could be an important point that we haven't touched on yet. You know, could this be a symptom of something a bit more serious, other than just being a bit tired?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So you have to think, what is normal for me? Is this my work-life balance? Is it my stress? Is it my health? So it's a point to be taken seriously. Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much indeed, Lucy, for taking the time to chat. Much appreciated.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you, Mike.
The station that makes you feel good.
Start your day the right way with Revive Active's range of super supplements and get the most out of life. Take one power-packed sachet mixed with water and enjoy a super tasty health drink at work, at home, or on the go. Clean, premium ingredients scientifically formulated to work in synergy to optimize your health and well-being to support immunity, energy, joints, heart health, and more. No filler, no stimulants, no artificial colors or preservatives, just the right mix of vitamins, minerals, amino acids, and hero ingredients to help you put back what life takes out. Try our 7-day or 30-day boxes and use code UK Radio to get a free supplement shaker. Revive Active. Super supplements for a super you.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
The station that makes you feel good.
Dr. Manish Mittal is a hair transplant surgeon, and my first question to him was, What's the route to becoming a transplant surgeon?
Yes, it's an interesting question. There is no real route, actually. There is no formal training in the NHS for such procedures. So someone like myself generally needs a mentor who will guide them through the early stages. And frankly speaking, it's about, you know, going and looking for training opportunities yourself. So I've traveled around the world to acquire skills and amalgamate them into what I believe to be the best practice. And ultimately, you know, when you first start off in your career, you're working on patients and you aren't as experienced as what you could be. And you don't really know what you don't know at that stage. So you're practicing by learning on patients. But generally speaking, you have to kind of forge your own path in this sector, unless you're very, very lucky.
Generally, I prefer surgeons that are not practicing on me, but have generally kind of done the practicing on someone else, I'd suggest.
Well, it's called the practice of medicine, right? So I think every patient is potentially being practiced on.
Yeah, no, I get it. All right. So, but it's different. So you're not a medic. You haven't been through medical school.
I have. Yeah. So when I talk about training, what I'm talking about is post medical school. So my background is I was doing orthoplastic training in terms of surgery. I broke my ankle, which meant that I had to find something a little different, something that I could do sat down. Ironic that is, because I was doing orthopedics, and then I go and break my own ankle. And, you know, I was very fortunate. I kind of knew a lot of people in the sector and they kind of guided me to doing something that I could do largely sat down. You know, when you're working for the NHS, you're on average doing 30 to 40,000 steps daily, going between wards, going to A&E, on call and so forth. And that's very tiring on a normal ankle, let alone an ankle that's not 100%. So that's why I kind of had to turn my hand to something a little different. So yeah, I went to University of Leicester for medical school. I worked for the UCL Deanery when I graduated, and that encompassed, you know, general surgery, orthopedics, a bunch of different specialties. And then ultimately, while I was in training for orthopedics, I had to let go of that number and focus on something full time. And for me, that's become hair restoration surgery. It's what I do day in, day out.
Okay. So you took the same route as any other surgeon. Yes. And in fact, you could be a brain surgeon, similar route to a brain surgeon, but kind of in the latter part of your career, you kind of go one way and the brain surgeon goes another way.
Yes, absolutely. Okay. Absolutely.
All right. But it strikes me that, you know, if you make a bit of a mistake or you sneeze during a part of the operation, if you're doing a hair transplant, it's somewhat less disastrous than if you sneeze while you've got your hands in someone's brain.
No, I would say, yeah, I think both can be quite catastrophic, actually, because when you're doing hair restoration surgery, you're creating lots and lots of micro holes. You know, someone like yourself, Mike, maybe would need 2,000 or so grafts at the front, and that would include, you know, 2,000.
Isn't good enough quality for you to see that, surely. you're right.
Yeah, but just broadly speaking, you know, 2,000 holes, micro holes, which are sort of, you know, a couple of millimeters in width and 5 millimeters in depth, it becomes a breeding ground for potential infection. So everything carries its own risk. When you've got open wounds, wherever it might be, if it's not done in a sterile form, then you're going to be putting yourself at risk of infection. Of course you are. Okay.
So the point being that whether you're having brain surgery or hair transplant surgery, there are some risks. All surgeries have risks. Actually, is hair transplant, is that done under a general anaesthetic? Surely not.
No, it's done under local, but there are situations where you can use things like sedation, so light sedation in particularly anxious patients, just like you would if you went to a dental practice, if you was, you know, getting a wisdom tooth removed, for example. Sometimes they offer you light sedation. You can use things like Entonox, which is laughing gas in essence, which can help, you know, prevent certain amount of pain, especially when you're doing the anesthesia. But yes, you know, 99.9% of the time, this is a walk-in, walk-out procedure performed under local anesthetic.
My point being, there are risks, but the risk of general anesthetic is usually not one of them.
Correct.
Yeah. All right. So there are concerns, or there have been concerns. Actually, it's been in the media with kind of plastic surgery and different things. This, what's it called? BBL, Brazilian bum lift.
Yes.
Being done not by surgeons, but by people that think, oh, I might be rather good at that. I think I'll have a go. Yeah. Does a similar problem exist with hair surgery? You know, do people think, yeah, I'll have a go at that. Why not?
Yes, I would say it does. Look, you know, broadly speaking, it can be a bit of a money spinner for anybody who's involved, you know, whether you're at the very beginning of your career, middle of your career, or right at the very top of your career. So people want to be a part of this industry. So, you know, if I put it broadly, Mike, you know, I could train you tomorrow to become a hair transplant technician and then have you making cuts into somebody's head the following day. And I don't know about you, but, you know, I'd feel a little bit uncomfortable from an ethical standpoint if that was the case. And I'm sure, you know, you wouldn't trust yourself to be making holes in a person who you just started working on the day before, for example. So the point that I'm trying to make is, yes, it is hugely unregulated and there are best practices, and best practices are generally the doctor should be the one that leads a medical consultation. So that's to ascertain if there's any allergies, you know, doing an in-depth, you know, proper medical consultation to make sure patients are actually fit for a surgery. And you have touched upon it. It is generally a very safe surgery, but there are some strong contraindications to performing such a surgery. And surely
it's illegal for someone to just go, yeah, I'll give it a go if they haven't been to medical school and all the rest of it.
No, you see, this is the problem. It's a bit of a gray area. You know, there's a movement in the industry as a whole to make sure that doctors are the ones performing the surgery. But, you know, when you go to some of the more commercial clinics who are trying to do 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 procedures in a single day at a slightly lower price point, a show has to be run. And that show generally involves a doctor, you know, kind of orchestrating a team of surgical technicians who are just normal people. You know, they could have been beauticians, they might have been a taxi driver, they might have been, you know, in a different industry altogether. And then these people are the ones...
They might have been a podcast host.
They could have been a podcast host.
Exactly. That's the thought.
Exactly that. But, you know, and I think it boils down to the doctor's ethics themselves. Like for me, I focus on one patient a day. I do most of the work myself, you know. Yes, I do have assistants involved who are going to help me sort and clean and separate the grafts. Aside from that, I do all the surgical cuts are done by me. All the administration of local anesthetic is done by me. And unfortunately, this is not happening across the sector as a whole. That it also includes the UK, which makes the UK a very, very dangerous place.
So these people aren't breaking the law per se?
Well, I think this is the problem with the industry that we're in as a whole. The cosmetic sector is quote unquote regulated, but it's kind of self-regulation, if that sort of makes sense.
All right.
So unless doctors hold themselves accountable, and often doctors don't even know that they're doing something wrong because this is just the way that they've been taught a procedure should be performed. They're not asking the why. Why is it that I'm not the one making the cuts into the person's head? It's just considered normal that you run a show, let the assistants do the work, and you know you're just there to make sure nobody gets sick, in essence. Right.
Goodness me. All right. So if people are considering having something like this done, and I presume there's a whole host of reasons why they might have something like this done, is there a simple way they can check if the guy they're talking to is... has a host of people who the day before were taxi drivers and they're going to be let loose on your head, or is just doing it a little more sensibly? Because obviously, you know, it sounds like there's gold in them there hills, and it's quite a lucrative business. So people might act not quite as they should do.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Look, there isn't really a way for people to know whether the person performing the surgery on their head was a taxi driver or podcast host the day before, and now they've decided they want to embark upon a new journey. But this is why it's important that patients educate themselves on what parts of the process the doctor should actually be doing. And this is what I kind of, you know, describe as the pillars of a good surgery. How many patients are being performed a surgery on that day? What parts of the procedure is the doctor going to be actually involved in? If they are the only ones that are making the surgical cuts, then you know it's going to probably be a slightly more safer procedure. Number two, who's going to be administering the local anesthetic? How long is it that you're speaking to a doctor prior to surgery? You know, Mike, this is one of the only sectors, and it's hugely commoditized as a result of it, but it's one of the only sectors where you could have a medical consultation performed by a non-doctor, get prepped for surgery, pay your money, pay your deposit. On the day of the procedure, it's the only time you've actually met the doctor. And for the, and you know, generally speaking, sometimes people don't even remember what the name of the doctor was or is going to be. And that is a hugely scary thought. You know, you wouldn't let somebody generally cut holes into your head without doing a little bit of due diligence. This is not the NHS. This is the private sector. I think patients need to be actively doing that due diligence on the prospective surgeon.
Yeah, goodness. I mean, the whole thing does sound a little bit scary. And has demand for this thing increased recently?
Yes.
I suppose it has done, which is why this situation has arisen.
Yeah, I mean, it's always been a high in demand thing that a lot of men, women are asking for. You know, hair loss can be hugely debilitating on one's mental health. You know, in the pandemic, there was a certain surge of people requesting a hair transplant procedure. In fact, it was probably one of the busiest times in the industry as a whole. Why? Because people were looking at themselves largely on camera. And, you know, a lot of the time, Mike, people aren't even looking at the person that they're speaking to on camera. They're more fixated on themselves. They're looking at the way that their hair looks. They're looking at the way that they're positioned on the camera. So it caused a huge spike in mental health concerns pertaining specifically to the way that people perceive themselves as an aesthetic.
Okay. So yes, isn't this kind of a symptom of something else, though? So if you're not happy in your life, in yourself, and you see something like that, you think, oh, God, I'm losing a bit of hair. This is like a symptom of something else, isn't it? So, you fix the hair. You haven't fixed the problem. You fixed one of the symptoms. It seems okay. So I'm losing hair a little bit. You can see on the Zoom. I've got to say, it doesn't really worry me terribly much. So the whole thing just concerns me a bit.
I think it would be a bit premature to trivialize the entire industry with one smooth remark. But I will tell you this much: I speak to patients day in, day out who have a huge negative impact from the hair loss in itself. You know, they can't go on dates. They catch themselves in a reflection of just a window, and they leave that social scenario. People, you know, cower in themselves. They don't have the same confidence as what they might have had a decade prior. You know, when you walk into a room, you don't stand up tall. You kind of hope that nobody notices and you go and sit. So it holds people back in their life. It really does. And I see the remarkable changes within 12 to 18 months. You know, the same person who was not really smiling, not really joking, comes back in 12 to 18 months time and says to me, Manny, you know, it's truly changed my life. You know, I've got a girlfriend. You know, I've got a better job. I'm doing far better in life. I've lost 2 stone. It's kind of, you know, snowball. It's a snowball effect, right? It's pushed people into, and you're right, it is treating a symptom, but that one symptom, when treated, can have a huge impact on the quality of that individual's life as a whole. And you know, and that's important.
Yeah, of course. I mean, when people come to you saying they're thinking of having this done, do you ever kind of counsel them? Have you ever refused a patient because you think they're going it for the wrong reasons?
100%. And I think motivation is really important. Understanding, and you know, part of it is a bit of a, and this is why I talk about it being a medical centric consultation, because you need to dig in to the psyche of the person. What is it that they're hoping to achieve? What are their expectations? What is the long term goal? What, you know, really and truly, what is, it's not, it shouldn't just be a case of, oh, you know, my girlfriend told me I'm losing a bit of hair, so I should go and get this hair trial. No. It has to be more than that. Or, you know, some people have very unrealistic expectations. I want to have a hairline just above my eyebrows. Well, that's not going to happen either. So, yes, absolutely. There's a huge amount of counseling that goes into a hair restoration procedure before you say yes. And that's important.
Yeah. On this show, I've actually spoken to a plastic surgeon who was in the States, actually. Mm-hmm. And in his heyday, you know, he was one of these guys that did 8 to 10 operations a day, et cetera, et cetera. I won't give you his name. but he said it wasn't unknown for if he had done surgery on someone that then their relationship broke down after that. They felt they were punching below their weight. Suddenly, they were much better looking. They were much more confident. So they went off and found another partner.
This worries me. Yeah, I mean, look, that could happen in any walk of life. And like you said, maybe you're treating a symptom of a bigger problem to a certain extent. Maybe they're already unhappy in that relationship. You know, maybe they already feel a little bit undervalued in that relationship. And I think that's an important thing. It's not going to just be because, hey, I've got a better looking face. I've got more hair. You know, I feel a little bit tighter in my body. It doesn't work like that. You are at that point, you are just treating a symptom of a bigger problem. This is why counseling is hugely important. Understanding people's motivations.
No, I get it. All right. Interesting. Let's rein it back into the kind of in some ways, the more immediate issues. If you're thinking about this, you've suggested some questions you should ask a potential surgeon. Is there kind of a list, a professional body that you can go and check and see if your guy's on that list?
Yeah, I mean, the main list that I am a part of is the International Alliance of Hair Restoration Surgeons. And it's a body of surgeons, you know, 70 to 80 top world-class surgeons across the world. So, you know, and these are vetted surgeons, right?
You know, that's what I'm getting at, a list of vets. So you can see, right, my guy, he's got, you know, he's passed the various credentials, he's been okayed, he's on the list, probably won't make a muck up.
Yeah, and I'd say the only list that I'm aware of that actually provides something like that is the International Alliance of Hair Restoration Surgeons. It's actually a consumer-facing list, and it's not, you know, there's a bunch of lists which is associated more to teaching, collegiality, doesn't really tell you whether the surgeon is any good, okay? But the International Alliance of Hair Restoration Surgeons, it is a list which specifically categorizes the best surgeons across the world. You know, they've spoken to countless patients of that specific surgeon. There's probably only about 7 or 8 in the whole of Europe that are a part of that list. And I'm one of them. And, you know, across the world, there's probably only about 70 to 80 or so. So I'd certainly recommend people look at that list. I think it's also important in the UK, particularly if you are going to go to a licensed physician, check the GMC, make sure that they are still certified and good to go from that regard. And also ask people for their indemnity. You know, I think people need to make sure that their doctor is correctly insured, because if something went untoward, you know, insurance is also very, very important.
All right. So there's some things there that are really worth checking if you're thinking going down that route. If people are listening to this, I think, right, I'd like to check out a bit more. Is there a sort of a resource they can look at online as a bit of an aid memoir for some of these points you've raised?
Yeah. I mean, look, my website is a pool of knowledge. It's called, you know, the Mithil Hair Clinic is the name of my clinic. Website is just www.mithilhairclinic.com. That in itself will give you a nice introduction as to what part of the processes a surgeon should be performing. You know, they can look at the British Association of Hair Restoration Surgeons, and they offer a good amount of information. I chose not to be a member of it. I went straight to the International Alliance of Hair Restoration Surgeons. But if you're looking for a good doctor in the UK, the BARS is a good pool of information on the whole. Doesn't necessarily mean that the surgeon's any good, but it certainly gives you kind of a good starting point on what questions you should be asking a specific surgeon.
Excellent. All right. Look, that's interesting, useful for people that are considering going down that path. So many thanks for chatting.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much to my guests on this week's show. And they were dietitian Lucy Diamond talking about lack of energy and feeling tired all the time. Dr. Manish Mittal, he's a hair transplant surgeon, talking about transplant surgery. And of course, thank you to you for listening, and have a healthy week until next week.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Stop suffering with pet-related allergies when near dogs and cats. Great news, you can feel safe around pets with Nasal Guard for pet lovers. Nasal Guard topical gel blocks pet dander, hair, and dust mites from entering your nasal passages. Try Nasal Guard for pet lovers today. Visit Amazon or nasalguard.co.uk to learn more about Nasal Guard spray and gel products. Again, that's nasalguard.co.uk.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries
and cream. A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Thanks for listening to the Relax Back UK show. Join me, Mike Dilk, again next week for more fascinating interviews and chat. If you're listening to the podcast version, please subscribe, like, and share it with your family and friends. And have a healthy week. Until next week.